The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
The last minute.
Not really.
Did you mute your phone?
I didn't mute
Darn
my phone.
It, I was going to call him. Why do I ruin my own fun? Hey, you're listening to We the People Radio. It is Sunday morning, of course.
KCNR, 1460 AM.
Shasta ready.
Shasta ready.
We're supposed to do that at the end of the hour. We stink at that. We're better at it at the beginning. Is there a broadcasting loophole for that?
Oh, a window? Ideally, it should be between 5 minutes before the hour and 5 minutes after the hour. Somewhere in there, you need to say the call letters and the city of license.
Man.
We better get that right, because I understand they're going to have watchers here.
Ooh,
pretty quick.
Yeah, better have listeners.
We're going to bring in another
chair.
Come
and check and see if we combed our hair
in the
morning.
We'll give them a chair.
Yeah.
Give them someplace to sit. Something to sit on.
Sure, Bill.
Yeah.
She'll say yes, Aaron.
Yes, Aaron, really? That is correct.
You are referring to the FCC's proposal to stick their nose under the tent in the nation's newsrooms.
That's right.
I could hear the excitement all the way across the country. So let's see. You can join us online once I get there. I'm not there either.
At wethepeopleradio.us.
Bingo.
I beat you to it.
Nice. Are you already there? No.
No, because I'm not streaming yet.
Your computer's still booting up. Lovely.
I'm not streaming or chatting live right now, but I bet a lot of other people are.
You could you can call us if you'd like. We don't have a lot of calling in on Sunday morning. People are kind of hanging out, drinking coffee, listening to political ideas. But the phone number here is 530-605-4567. And we've got Tim Daughtry on with us this morning. He's the author of Waking the Sleeping Giant. And we were just talking about that on the way in. You know, we are the product of Waking the Sleeping Giant.
That's right.
None of us were doing anything with...
Yeah, who'd have thunk we'd have been on the radio 3 years ago?
Three years and then some, yeah.
Yeah.
three years and change.
Yeah. Who would have thought you would have been? You were like the coffee guy.
Yeah.
You got promoted.
I know it.
Or demoted, since you didn't want to really be on the air. I guess you got demoted.
I got reassigned.
He started out as the intern, and look where he is now.
Yeah,
look at him.
Look, there is opportunity in this country.
for people who are willing to volunteer.
Yeah.
Good job, volunteer Bill.
You know, and I didn't do it for the money either, obviously.
You just did it.
Because
you open the door now. No, I'm just going to leave you hanging. I'm going to do like I used to do to Elizabeth, because that was my favorite gig.
I did it because I am the people.
Uh-huh.
I have a voice now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Bob, it was supposed to be funny. There was supposed to be something funny in there, right?
I could be Ron. Ron is not funny.
Bill's enamored with Ron from Parks and Rec. Parks and Rec guy.
Oh,
Parks and Recreation.
The NBC series.
Yeah.
Yeah, you didn't have to say NBC, because that makes it a yucky series. But yeah, actually, if you want to have some fun, I had to send it to Robert so he could put it on the website. It's called The Pyramid of Greatness.
All the things that are important in Ron's life.
Yeah, it's like his priorities. It's really funny. Okay, we'll get that pulled together for everybody before I start laughing. Alrighty. I am trying desperately to read you. See, this is why oftentimes I print the bio of the person. Here we go. Bing, there he is.
He's a handsome man.
He is, and he wrote a handsome book. Dr. Daughtry, he's a conservative writer and speaker, here we go, with a long history in conservative politics, unlike us, who were products of Waking the Sleeping Giant.
We make it up as we go along.
What?
Well, you do.
You wait. I'm just going to leave you there with all that dead air. I need to turn my chair so I can watch you while I'm speaking.
You better watch.
I turn my back on you. That's like the first rule of. That's a huge mistake. Okay. Do you have it? Oh my gosh, is your computer still booting up?
Yeah, I have top technology, top shelf stuff right here.
That is awesome. Yeah. I would have broken it by now. Let's see. So he regularly speaks to grassroots groups around the country, as well as Republican elected officials at the local, state, and national level. He works to convince the conservative movement that winning elections will never be enough as long as the liberal minority dominates our cultural institutions. His primary focus is giving conservatives practical strategies to get off the defensive in dealing with liberal strategy and tactics and to recover our culture from the grassroots level. So that's like... that's like talking to all of our folks.
Yep.
You know, because the number of people who were professionally or real deeply involved in politics prior to like 5 years ago was much, much smaller. I don't even know what the numbers would be, but I'm
yeah,
I would
I
say like
either,
a,
but yeah,
a tenth.
It used to be just the rich and powerful or the highly educated people were involved in politics. Nobody
actually
really knew how it worked.
Just sort of people who focused that way. I don't know if their folks were involved or... you know,
yeah, I mean, but it was the,
we were
it was
part of the
few.
We were part of the we were part of the dopey electorate that
we
they
were the knuckleheads.
They were like sheeple. They were like, why don't they ever pay attention? Like, we don't know.
We were just going along.
So nice sheeple. So how are we doing?
Dr. Daughtry is standing by.
Nice. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ooh. We instead of having the up and down cell signal like we so often get, we're gonna have a great chat. We're gonna be able to actually hear you. That's
good.
Outstanding. It sounds like you're right here. Hey,
oh, great. That's good to hear.
So, okay, we've wanted to have you on for quite a while, and then I don't know, just never did it. But this you know subtitle of Waking the Sleeping Giant is How Mainstream Americans Can Beat Liberals at Their Own Game. And I got to tell you, it's been like 5 years, I guess, that lots of people have been up off the couch. But we still haven't beaten the liberals at their own game, so it's time for you to work your magic.
Well, I'm hoping we can do that because we're running out of time.
Yes, we are. So what were you doing before you wrote this book and before you started looking at this? Or have you been involved in this for a really long time?
I've been involved in politics since my college days, which was a really long time ago. I go back to the 1960s, the late 60s in college, so I've dated myself there. But I was a member of a couple of conservative groups, and in the 1960s, of course, we could have our meetings at the back table in the coffee shop because there weren't a lot of conservatives on campus. But in my earlier life, I was active in Republican politics. I've been a local official. I've gone to conventions. I've worked in campaigns. I was active in the Americans for Reagan campaign. So early in my life, I was very active in conservative politics. Began to get very busy with the rest of my career. I'm a clinical psychologist by training, but pretty quickly after getting into clinical psychology, began to move into management of clinical systems. I was an executive in several treatment centers. And so I just, like a lot of people, got complacent, I think, and got busy with my career and had not been particularly active in politics. I continued to read. I continued to read conservative media and read conservative books, but just hadn't been very active. But like a lot of people that you're talking about 5 years ago, what I began to see was that what had been a gradual wearing away of the American system, a gradual wearing away of our constitutional republic over many years, suddenly began to look more like a blitzkrieg. With the election of Obama and the sheer radical nature of that agenda, I think stunned me, and it stunned millions of Americans. And so I began to get active again, and very quickly began to realize what we're going to talk about today, which is mainstream America has not figured out the game of politics very well. We're still thinking in terms of civics. We're still thinking that if you understand the Constitution and you're a good citizen and you pay your taxes and you work for a living and you try to support yourself, and you do your civic duty, you show up and vote and try to inform yourself on the issues, we tend to think that that's enough, and then we put people in office and just hope that they will protect our constitutional liberties. And as I say in the book, trusting politicians to guard your rights is like trusting a dog to guard your dinner. It's just not the nature of the animal.
We have one of those that would be a poor guard dog.
So It was that, I think it was that realization that that we've got to do something differently, and that was the birth of Waking the Sleeping Giant. The effort to put something else out there for conservatives to read and understand that basically makes the case what we're doing isn't working. And we have got to change our strategy, we have got to change our tactics, because we are in what I think of as sort of a Valley Forge moment in our country's history here. We're not winning a lot, and our troops are energized, they're certainly there, they're still in the fight, but there's this nagging feeling that it may be too late. When I do book signings, when I do speeches around the country, very often somebody will come up to me, and it's always one-on-one. They don't raise these questions in a large group. It's a discouraging question, but people who are working very hard to turn the country around will sometimes look at me and say, do you just think it's too late? Have we lost too much ground? Do you think it's over? And that concerns me, because I think that attitude in itself could defeat us.
Yeah.
So I think we've got to change our thinking, we've got to change our strategy, and we've got to change our tactics.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I think a lot of people, though, when they've been involved in the past in different projects, they get involved, they map out a plan, and then they get results, and the project's done. Whereas this is, it's never done, and the results aren't there immediately, and a lot of times the results you get aren't what you want.
Well, it's also, I think it's hard for people to gauge the results. I think that's a huge factor. I don't think they realize, because they keep hearing the talking heads on TV saying things like, the Tea Party's dead and whatnot, and people go, uh-oh.
Yeah.
They still don't know we're here.
We're also the new kids on the block, and we don't understand all the rules, and the best laid plans come along, and boom, we get knocked off the rails, and then you hear, it's too late, we can't win.
I think you're right. I think the expectation that we'll see immediate and quick results is a problem. In my day job, I consult, I haven't done clinical psychology for years, but I work in organizations. I work with organizations on, like you're talking about, mapping out their plan, mapping out their strategy, and developing their executives. One of the points we make is executives move from early in their career, sort of at the line management level, to middle and senior management. Is that what we call the time horizon has to get longer and longer. If you're a line engineer, you're working on projects and you see results pretty quickly. And so we get accustomed, and these are the kinds of people who are doers. We like to have a to-do list. We like to check things off that to-do list, and we get a sense of gratification and completion. And as you get promoted in management and you move higher and higher and higher, and you begin to think about things like acquisitions and moving into new markets and changing the culture of the organization, you don't see those immediate results. And so we see this all the time with executives, that we have to learn to see a more complex picture. We have to learn to think in terms of the long haul. And I think that's one of the things that has been a problem for conservatives, is that we've thought repeatedly, we put Reagan in 1980, we've won elections before. There have been Republican landslides or even conservative landslides, if you will. But we then go back home. We think, well, okay, we've done that. We checked that off the list. We've been thinking in terms of winning the next election. I think the left has been focused on winning the next generation, and we have got to start thinking more long-term and realize, particularly in the mess we're in now, and I think you hit a very important point, the Tea Party is going to have to mature. The Tea Party is going to have to come of age politically and realize we did some great work in 2010. The nation was ready in 2010. But this is going to have to be a long-term sustained effort. We're not going to get this country out of the mire overnight. We're going to have a long-term plan. And I think we're going to have to learn to win at compromise. Part of the problem is we've been losing at compromise. It's like we talk about in the book, the left proposes, and then we resist, we argue, we debate, and then the left continues to put on pressure, they wear us down, and we eventually compromise. And in the book, we call that the appeasement cycle. And the whole idea there is appeasement has gotten us into the mess we're in. But I think long-term, the conservative movement is going to have to figure out, we're going to have to gain back ground that we've lost. And that's the big concern I have. I think our mindset right now is defensive, and I think the first thing we've got to do is change that defensive mindset.
And how do you get people out of the mindset that, you know, I hear so many people say, we have to stop compromising. You know, we take, you know, the liberals take two steps forward and one step back, and we're always losing, and we have to take a no-compromise stance. I think that's the part of politics that so many people don't understand, is if there's no compromise, there's no progress, I don't believe.
Absolutely, and I think we have to, one of the ways you convince people, and I've been trying this out, and sometimes Tea Party audiences look at me kind of funny when I make this point, when I say one of the things we have to do is get better at compromise. I think it helps if you can draw a distinction between appeasement and strategic compromise. Appeasement is what we've been doing for decades. The left realized decades ago that a gradual strategy would eventually wear away the constitutional foundations of our liberty. I mean, they've been doing this for over 100 years, going back to the progressives in the late 1800s. The Fabian socialists in England had the same idea. Those ideas intellectually influenced a lot of leftist thinkers in the United States. The cultural Marxism that I'll talk about in a few minutes, the whole idea there has been gradually wearing away the foundations, the cultural foundations and the political foundations of our freedom. And the whole idea has been to demand 100%, but then settle for 10%. So the left comes up with these grandiose demands, and we have whittled them down, we thought, over the years. So we'd say, okay, well, we'll give you 10%. We won't give you 100% of what you want, but we'll give you 10%. Well, the left has taken that 10%, and they've come back the next year and got another 10%.
Yeah, and I think that's what people are so...
So that, I think, is why the Tea Party movement has been so burned by the sense of compromise. But that really wasn't compromise. That was appeasement. I think our attitude there was, if we give them some of what they want, they will back down. They'll quit. They'll go away. Well, the left doesn't go
away. Yeah, they're never going away.
They don't go away. They don't stop. There's never enough. And so appeasement, I think, is the vain hope that we can satisfy the left. We'll never satisfy the left until we have total socialism. And so I think what we have to do is draw the distinction between appeasement and compromise. We can gain ground in a compromise. And this is where I hope the Tea Party will begin to come of age, is to realize that, you know, we're putting people in a very delicate position here. We're putting them in positions of power, and we're saying, okay, go change the system. Well, they can't change it overnight because we didn't lose it overnight. So what we have to be able to do is realize when we have gained 10% or 20% instead of losing 10 or 20%. And that's a very different way of thinking about politics. And as you pointed out earlier, that's going to mean that we have to think long term. We can't just think that we're going to put people in office and this thing is going to be fixed. We're going to have to put people in office, and we're going to have to stay on them. We're going to have to continue to lobby. We're going to have to push and gain back the ground that we've lost.
Well, as soon as we, you know, as soon as you mention the word compromise, you know, people flare up. And I think that we're really, and by we, I mean, you know, people that are new to politics, say in the last 5 years or so, we're really vulnerable to being played by the left, and they're excellent at it. Like, two recent examples, one was really telling, was that comment by Pat Caddell on Fox, where he made comments about the Republicans in Congress aren't really pressuring the IRS because they're really actually using the IRS to take out the Tea Party.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my God, since when do we take, like, political advice from a Democratic strategist?
So many people believed that.
People were so mad about it. And it's like, hey, by the way, they're playing us.
Yeah, yeah.
We've got to get a little bit more sophisticated on that kind of thing.
And that's what I mean when I say we've been thinking in terms of civics. You know, you ask conservative Americans, and they'll tell you what the Constitution says, and they'll tell you about separation of of powers and all these great things in the Constitution. And we naively think when we put people in political positions that they're going to live that way. And politics is a dirty business. The game is not civics. The game is politics. And we have to learn to think, I like to think morally we can be innocent as doves, but we need to be crafty as serpents when it comes to dealing with the hardcore left. Because the hardcore left for over 100 years has had a strategy, and that strategy, it's not conspiratorial. You can read their books, you can read their writings, you can listen to their lectures in the universities. They have had a long-term strategy. They believe that history is on their side and that socialism is inevitable. And I think we have been so busy minding our own business and taking care of our families and doing our jobs, taking care of our business. Mainstream Americans just don't really understand the game of politics, and we get sucker punched all the time.
Yeah. What would be one thing, like, if you were going to, outline for people to give them a really clear picture of what a good compromise would look like? Because, honestly, just bringing that word up makes you a bad guy.
I've had those moments. I've been talking to Tea Party audiences, and the first part of the talk, they're cheering, they're happy, because I'm talking about we need to get off the defensive, we need to think long term, we need to take the fight to the other side, and so they're just as happy as they can be. When I hit that point about folks, we have got to learn to compromise strategically, they look at me.
Out comes the rope,
and out comes the rope, and that's when I have to stand my ground, and I'll stand there toe-to-toe with the audience and say, okay, somebody in here tell me, how many of you would like to eliminate useless federal departments and unconstitutional federal departments? And every hand goes up. And then I say, okay, now tell me the last time we did that. And no hands go up. And I say, we can talk a good game all day long. We have never even cut the budget of an unconstitutional federal department, not to mention eliminating it. Let's start with actual cuts to unconstitutional departments or useless departments or superfluous departments. Let's have a real success. Right now, we can't even succeed sometimes when we slow the growth. The departments are still growing, and we get attacked for cutting them, and we still haven't figured out how to rebut that attack. So let's start with some real progress. Let's start by actually reducing the size and scope of some federal department. Make the case for that. Get that success under our belt. Come back the next year and reduce it again. And when we've learned to do that, then we can begin to build a case for eliminating departments. That's just one example.
I like that. I can think of some departments I'd like to eliminate. So
absolutely, and we've got to start just by reducing their power and their scope and their budget at some point. And right now, we're doing well to even slow the growth of them.
Yeah, and to stop the reach. I mean, because once we get back and can control their budgets, we can control what they spend, not just how much they spend, but what they spend it on. And at that part, you know, at that point, we start affecting the part that affects people on the ground.
And that's a long-term change in our thinking, too, because that's a legislative function. And we have given in, those of us in the political mainstream have just gradually given in to this idea of the administrative state. And the whole idea that budgets automatically increase, you start with where you were last year and then you add what you need to do. There is no justifying what you do. There's no justifying what you've done in the past. And so this idea of automatic increases has become it's become so deeply ingrained that's why they're able to claim that we're cutting the budget when all we do is reduce the size of an increase. So I think you're spot on. When we have tighter legislative control over the budget, and that means we're going to have to change the thinking of our legislators. Our legislators have pretty much become secondary to the executive branch and to the judicial branch. They don't take the power that is theirs to take constitutionally, and control over the budget and control over scope of spending is the first step. I think you're spot on.
Well, I think that's a great point, because I don't think people realize that Congress doesn't have a lot of the powers they think they do.
They want them to have, they want them to have things that really they shouldn't have. They want them to have, you know, litigation power. You know, why aren't they arresting these people in the IRS? You know, why aren't they firing them? It's like, well, they don't have the ability to do either one of those things, but we're a little, I think we're a little weak sometimes on what they, what people can really do.
Right, they have budgetary control and they can do investigations, but when you're talking about the kinds of things you're talking about, that gets back into the administrative state. It gets back into the Justice Department to handle those things.
Right.
And so we have just not really understood how the machinery works. We think that once Congress knows about something, Congress can do something about it. Well, Congress needs to be focused on understanding what's going on with our budget right now. That's the main constitutional responsibility, is the spending authority, and Congress has almost abdicated that. I mean, people vote on budgets and have no idea what's in the budget.
Exactly.
Yeah, there are always too many moving parts. Let's take a really quick break. We're going to come back with Dr. Tim Daughtry. We're discussing topics related to Waking the Sleeping Giant. You can check everything out on the webpage, wethepeopleradio.us. And we'll be right back with you here at KCNR, 1460 AM.
There you go. There you have it.
Oh, we summed it all up in one song back from our college days. So, so Dr. Daughtry, put on your doctor hat. How do we cure this? It's just interesting. You know, people want, like we're having a little discussion in the chat room here about the budget. And so people don't want them to compromise on the budget because obviously they don't want the budget to go up. However, if the Republicans, you know, threaten things that they can't follow through with because they're in the majority in the House, but they're not the majority of Congress, how does that help everybody? I mean, it's a big feel good, but they kind of look like idiots and diminish their position.
Yeah, that's why I think one of the biggest things the conservative movement has to do is to begin to think long-term, number one, and number two, to stop thinking defensively, because we're not in a good position right now. If we, if we were to actually enact any cuts, if we were to try that, we'd be crucified in the news media, we'd be slaughtered in 2014. We have to build the case. I think we keep thinking that what happens behind the beltway is the key. Well, what happens across your dinner table is the key. What happens across your backyard fence? We've got to do a better job at making the case for what we want to do, because right now the news media are controlled basically by the left for the most part. Our schools are controlled by the left. So even if we enact an agenda inside the beltway, that agenda is going to be undermined in our cultural institutions, and the left has focused on those for decades. And so I think that's why I say we have to think strategically. We have to build a base, make the case, and work our way toward why we're trying to go. Now, I'm not saying that we compromise when we have the power and we have the votes to win. I'm not saying that.
Sure.
I'm just saying that we have to begin to think long term. Let me give you just an example, and this has been resonating with Tea Party audiences. It's kind of a guilty moment when we really think about it. I like to put up two images on the screen when I'm talking to Tea Party audiences and have them think about what that means. One is the forward symbol of the Obama campaign, and I ask the audience, well, tell me what comes to mind when you think forward? And of course, most of them, these are informed people. They realize that that's the old socialist slogan from Europe. It was adopted by a number of socialist groups, and the Obama campaign simply adopted that. But forward suggests that we've got a plan, we've got an agenda, we have an end game, we are marching towards something. The left has that attitude, and they have for decades, that they're working toward European-style socialism, and that's why they don't see a compromise as a failure. If they gain 10%, they're not angry with their people that they didn't gain 100%, because they know that they're going to come back next year and get another 10%. They think long-term. That's what the whole forward, the long march idea was. Well, the other symbol I put up is our symbol, the Don't Tread on Me flag. But what does that symbolize? Don't Tread on Me basically says, I'm going to mind my own business. I expect you to mind your own business. And if you get in my face, I will back you down. If you get in my turf, I will back you down. Don't Tread on Me basically connotes the idea that we will defend our liberty when it's under attack. But I want everyone to hear that that is a basic defensive mindset. And the conservative movement, going back to the days of Edmund Burke, has been a defensive movement. The left proposes cultural changes, they propose legislative changes, they have a political agenda, and we wait for bailouts, Obamacare, their global warming strategy, whatever it is, amnesty, gun control. We wait to see what they're going to do, and then we respond. Well, the case I've been making to conservative audiences around the country is we can't win a conservative fight, a defensive fight, because it's not enough now for us to try to hold off the left. What we have to do is regain ground that we've lost. That's what we're all talking about here today. The budget's out of control. We've got to get it back in control. That means regaining ground that we've lost. And you can't do that from a defensive position. So I think the first thing we really have to do is begin to realize that we've been thinking short-term, the left has been thinking long-term, and we've been thinking defensively. So we've got to think of a long-term strategy. So how do we get... Number one, how do we gain political power? To me, that means we've got to win in 2014, and we absolutely have to win in 2016. But it goes much beyond that. We have to begin to say, okay, now that the dog has caught the car, what are we going to do with it? When we get in office, we're like the dog that's chasing a car and finally catches it. We haven't figured out the political game. We don't know what to do next.
Well, what you were saying earlier about long term and short term, what I'm seeing is they have had these policies in the works for years and decades, and now to come along and make any kind of change to that, that's not going to be a long-term effect. It's going to be a short-term effect, and people are going to feel it right away, and now you're going to lose votes. How do you approach this long-term versus short-term issue when you're not in the driver's seat, but the changes that you make are going to affect people, and like you say, it's going to affect their dinner plate. Now you're the bad guy for trying to reverse the stuff that's been built, for the last, eon. I mean, how do you go about doing that without looking like the bad guy? Because now you're affecting people immediately.
I think that is the key question, because conservatism has almost always, by definition, I call myself a conservative, so this is a self-critique as well, but we're almost always in a negative position because we're in a defensive position. The left proposes something, and we're always in a position to say, well, no, we can't afford that, or that's not really in the Constitution, or that's not going to work, or that's been tried before. Well, if you're a business executive and you're always in the position of waiting for somebody else to propose something, and you're always saying, no, that won't work, well, you quickly get a reputation as a naysayer and negative and opposed to change and not having any ideas yourself. It's the same thing in a political movement. So I think what's critical is for us to begin to talk about positive solutions. Now, I'm not talking about compassionate conservatism. I'm not talking about big government run by conservatives. I'm talking about making a positive case for liberty instead of making a negative case. Instead of just leave me alone and stay out of my business, we need to be out talking to people and convincing the electorate that free enterprise and free markets do create prosperity. Free enterprise and free markets are better for poor people as well as for rich people. We have lost that argument so often, and yet all the evidence is on our side. The left always uses arguments like, well, when you have capitalism, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Well, the rich do get richer. That part of it is true. But the poor don't get poorer. The poor do better under free markets. The poor, and we've seen that in China, we've seen that in India, we've seen that wherever there's been a loosening of state control, the standard of living for people at the bottom goes up just as well as people at the top.
But don't you think jumping right back in, and I'm, don't get me wrong, I'm totally for free markets, but if you eliminate a lot of the subsidies and free, you know, free food and everything else people are getting, and get back to a free market economy, a true free market economy, there's going to be so many people put out by that, that you're just going to lose votes, and they're going to swing hard the other way again to get their stuff back. I mean, how do you solve that problem?
I think you're absolutely right. That's why it's got to be long-term. See, if we don't have a long-term strategy, if we don't know what we're working toward, then any time one of our politicians compromises on something or cuts 10% instead of cutting 100%, then they're going to be, it's like you said earlier, then we get out the rope and we say, well, you're just one of those compromisers. You're one of those people that got us in this mess. I think we have to first off know where we're trying to go, that we're working our way back toward free markets. To do that, we have to make a cultural case. That's what the left has understood. You win the battle in the culture. And the left has done that. I can talk about that if you want, but the left has done a great job of changing our culture, creating a sense of entitlement, a sense of expectation that government's going to do things. Well, folks, we're not going to change that overnight. It's naive to think that we are. So I think you're absolutely right. And there actually is a conservative case. This goes back to kind of the old Edmund Burke days that conservatism is also about order, and when there is change, that change has to be orderly change. And for us to suddenly, I've said this to so many audiences, if we were to suddenly get back to strict constitutional government, if we were to suddenly get back to free markets, we would create chaos. We'd send this economy into a spiral. We'd have riots in the streets. And that is not conservative. Creating radical change, and we've been passive for so long, we're now in a position that getting back to constitutional government suddenly would be a radical change, and it would create chaos.
Exactly, and that's people are afraid of is we vote these conservatives back in, and they're going to change all this, and we will have riots in the streets because people are going to starve, and the kids won't get their free lunches, and we won't have our cell phones, and on and on and on. That's what we're going to hear. If we take too big a bite, but if we don't take a bite, then we get accused of compromising.
And that's why I say you're absolutely right, I think, and that's why I say we've got to change our whole approach to politics, because what we've been doing is putting people in office and say, okay, you guys go do what you campaigned on, and we'll see you in 2 years, and if we don't like what you did, we'll give you a primary. What we need to be doing is putting our people in office and then talking to our neighbors, talking to our kids, finding out what they're hearing at school, being ready to make the case. There are reasonable things that we can do to get this budget under control. They're not radical. But we're going to have to make the case, because the left is going to be accusing us of starving children and throwing old people out on the streets.
Yeah.
The Tea Party's penny plan was just one example. I'm not saying that is the thing to do, but the idea of cutting 1%. I mean, it's hard for the left to make the case when American families have had to cut back here and cut back there. They've had to reduce their travel. They've had to reduce their vacations. They've had to reduce their spending. It's hard for the government to make the case that they can't find a penny on every dollar, especially when every now and then we hear about the waste. I mean, just huge conferences, and they go to Las Vegas or wherever, and they just waste money like crazy. It's hard for them to make the case that they can't cut a penny. Well, folks, everybody listening, please think of this. I know that may not sound like much, but for us to actually get a 1% cut would be a tremendous gain, and it would have a tremendous impact on the trajectory of our spending. So I think we're on the same page there, that we can't radically change government that has gradually gotten into a mess. We have to gradually get out of the mess, and we as conservatives have to do a better job of making that case to people.
Exactly, yeah. And when we do get the right people in there, it's not every they make a vote they don't like. It's vote them out. You know, that's they made the wrong choice.
Well, we're like teenagers.
We want it all the first time, and you make one decision that they don't agree with, they want to throw you out and start over again. And I think you're right. We have to educate the people as to why we have to take this a bite at a time.
Exactly. Okay, on that happy note, we're going to come back, but it's going to be in 2 minutes. We need to thank our advertisers. We're here speaking with Dr. Tim Daughtry regarding his book and ideas surrounding Waking the Sleeping Giant. Be right back with you.
A little secret that nobody knows. Life is a gamble, a game we all play. But you need to save something for a rainy day. You've got to learn to play your cards right if you expect to win in life. Don't put it all on the line for just one roll. You've got to have an ace in the hole.
Poets, priests, and politicians have words to say for their position.
We're back.
So much good political music we've listened to all our lives, and we didn't even know what they were saying until now. Hey, Dr. Daughtry, go to just before we hit the top of the hour here. What's your take on all this? The Tea Party and conservative activist community, when they're going after the Republicans and basically giving the Democrats in lots of cases kind of a free ride.
One of the arguments that I've been making is that there are certainly Republicans that I'm frustrated with, but one of the arguments I've been making to Republican audiences as well as Tea Party audiences is just exactly that. None of us is going to agree on everything, because the conservative movement is a diverse movement. I mean, Pat Buchanan can make an excellent case for protecting American markets, and Thomas Sowell can make an equally good case for having free trade. I want to listen to those arguments, but the best debates are on the right, if you think about it. But that also means that we're not going to agree about everything. So I think until we begin to mature as a movement, we're going to have to realize we're not going to agree on everything, but the divisions right now are helping the left, and the left wants nothing more than to see the Republican Party and the Tea Party fighting among ourselves. I don't mean we've got to compromise. I don't mean we've got to sacrifice what we believe, but I'm saying we have to mature as a movement, think long term. The left had a phrase decades ago, "I have no enemies on the left." And they lived by that. That's how the labor movement and the Marxists and the socialists and the social democrats and the Fabian socialists, that's how they put aside their differences and said, long term, we're going to work towards socialism. And we have to learn to think politically, too, or I think we're going to lose this country.
No, I think you're right. I see that so much in the media where they're trying to pit the Tea Party against the Tea Party, the conservative Republicans against the Tea Party, and then they'll come out and say, oh, the Tea Party is dead. They have no power. You know, if they keep talking about us, that must mean we're doing something right, and they're afraid. They're afraid of what the potential is of the Tea Party movement if we ever do get this figured out and start rewriting the rules a little bit. That I truly believe they know they're going to be in serious trouble.
Oh, I think the biggest threat facing the far left in this country is the Tea Party. They realize last thing they want to see is an informed and engaged mainstream America. And that's really what the Tea Party is. For all this talk of extremism and so forth, it really is just mainstream America. People who realize that we cannot borrow and spend and tax our way out of a budget crisis.
And maybe that's part of what the Tea Party needs to do is a little better job of marketing who they are. Because I hear, you know, the people that are down on the Tea Party, the reasons they don't like the Tea Party are totally incorrect. And I think maybe that's one angle we need to work on is a better understanding of what the Tea Party movement is about. Because they are from all walks of life. They are from all, you know, different ethnic groups.
But much of what you're basing that on is what the media gives us, which is all part of being played.
Well, no, but a lot of it is what I see in the Tea Party, though. I mean, I know what the Tea Party is about,
But you're not ever going to see that in the mainstream media.
No.
It's never coming. I mean, they're not going to say, oh my gosh, these people are sophisticated and marvelous, and they're going to, you know, fix the whole world. I mean, it's never coming.
No, you're right.
But I think the part that we can change is that certainly people are frustrated, they're angry, they're scared, but we have to realize that anger only goes so far in politics. Anger is a turnoff in politics. People begin to discredit you if you sound angry and negative. Now, there's a lot to be angry and negative about, but we have to learn to manage that. We have to think long-term. We have to mature as a movement. I think we need to spend more time talking about what we're for and why we're for it. Why do we believe in free markets? Why do we believe that we can work our way back to constitutional government? And what benefits will be for people instead of constantly talking about what's wrong with what the left is doing. But when we're constantly talking about what's wrong with the left, we are letting the left determine the terms of debate. We're arguing on their terms. So I think we have to do a better job of teaching our children, teaching our neighbors, teaching the electorate why freedom works, why liberty works, and why life will be better for most Americans if we work our way back toward a free enterprise economy.
Oh, I think that's right on target.
I think you hit the nail on the head. And guess what? We have an extra hour with Dr. Tim Daughtry coming back. We're going to be talking about Waking the Sleeping Giant in hour two of We the People. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us. Be right back with you.
Oh yeah, hour two. Next here at KCNR Shasta Redding. Stay tuned for more of We the People.
Second hour of We the People Radio here on KCNR 1460. And if you want to call in, our number is 605-4567. And the streaming and chatting on wethepeopleradio.us. And Aaron has
I have announcements. Okay, so I forgot last hour, so I'm doing it this hour. All right. So the way we fund this program one of the quick ways, and also bring speakers to our area. That's our plan in the future. So Conservative Radio for the North State is how we named our fundraiser, because it is for We the People, which airs obviously now 8 to 10 Sunday mornings, and then Sovereign Minds comes on right after us from 10 to 11 every Sunday. So it's our second annual banquet and fundraiser. It is Saturday, March the 8th at Wind River Casino, and tickets are $30 for individual, $50 for a couple, $400 to sponsor a table.
What do you get for that $400?
A $300 raffle ticket package.
Yeah, which is actually $400 worth of raffle tickets and some great stuff they're going to raffle.
Exactly. So gun auction, and if you're not into guns, we're having a dessert auction. It's probably about as far away as we can get.
And a table is eight people you can bring.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it was super fun last year. We're going to have some great speakers. We have Sam Paredes from Gun Owners of California. We've got Mark Baird, who will be giving a nice little snippet overview on the state of Jefferson. He is a great speaker. Both of those guys are great speakers. Congressman Doug LaMalfa will be in attendance. I'm not sure about the other public officials, but I know that Linda Kent will have information on that next hour. She'll have the latest and greatest because she's the genius behind this whole thing. The rest of us are just lackeys.
Well, I want to go. Where can I get tickets to go to that?
You can get tickets at Jones Fort.
Now, do you have to donate all your winnings at Wind River Casino that night to the conservative
popular,
or is that optional?
No,
that's totally
optional.
It's super optional, but possible. You could, well, you know, if you win your guns, you won't have them that night, so you can still go in the casino because you won't actually look like, you know, an armed militant, but it's fun to look like one later when you pick up your winnings.
Take your guns to the casino.
Just sling them over your
good
shoulder.
Advice.
Welcome to Israel, huh? So, you can get your tickets at Jones Fort here in town. You can get them from North State Consultants. Phone number is 221-0101. You can get them from Bill and I. Our phone numbers are on the web. Go to wethepeopleradio.us. All this information is there, along with contact information. We would be happy to bring those tickets to you, as long as you don't live in Iowa or something like that. And Suzanne in South Korea, we can't bring you tickets either. but the rest of the people, we could probably deliver. Let's see, what else do we have? Next week on the program, we have Fred Kelly Grant.
Oh, that's right. Big doings going on there.
Actually, yes. He is working on pressing back on CARB. And this isn't just one of those informational science shows. This is how we beat them politically and make CARB go away. So that's the California Air Resources Board, or as we have borrowed from one of our previous show guests, the California Arbitrary Rules for Bankruptcy, because that's what it's turning out to be.
Yes, and he is taking on the whole legal side of that and going to have
he's made some great headway in some other states on similar projects. So you guys, stay tuned. That'll be next Sunday on the radio. He will be speaking in Reading next Monday night. And then tomorrow night at the Tea Party, just might as well put that in there while we're at it, Monday night, tomorrow the 24th, will be Sam Paredes from Gun Owners of California.
That's right.
So we wanted to get him here in advance of the fundraiser. He does a great job.
Been a lot of changes in the California gun laws
of
January.
Yes.
So you might want to come and hear what has changed and the do's and don'ts and
exactly
all that fun stuff.
And Dr. Daughtry, I thought you would like Sam's explanation of how the conservatives fight the left. I don't know if you guys travel in the same circuit or not, but you should. You guys are similar mindset. Sam always says that fighting with the left, what conservatives always do, the liberals run in and they tell you they're going to chop your arm off. We're going to chop your arm off, and it's a credible threat. So the conservatives huddle up, they make a plan, and they decide they can have their hand. As long as they can keep the whole arm and they walk away happy.
That's the appeasement cycle.
Yeah.
And every toddler in the world has learned to do that. Every toddler in the world has learned at some point that if mom and dad are tired and they're in a store and they just want to go home, they just want to make dinner and relax, every toddler in the world has learned at some point that if you make enough noise, you can get your way. And the left has learned to do that. The left has learned to put pressure on us, and we reason, we argue, we debate, we pull out the Constitution. None of that matters to the left. They eventually exact an appeasement out of us, and then they repeat the cycle.
Well, I don't know how you were raised, but when I made a lot of noise, I didn't get my way. I got something, but it wasn't exactly what I had planned.
Well, it's funny, though. I was on the phone yesterday with my daughter back in Maine, and they were trying to get my three-year-old granddaughter to eat a sandwich. I guess she doesn't eat them if you cut them. I'm thinking, really?
Oh, it's those sharp edges.
Yeah, she cut the sandwich in half. She won't eat it. So then she had to sit in this yellow chair. So we're having this conversation while these edicts are going out, right? You must sit on the yellow chair. Well, I said, how's that yellow chair thing working out? She goes, oh, well, she dragged it all the way over by her bedroom because we didn't say she had to sit at the yellow chair by the table. I was like, man, you got to be kidding me.
Well, I think we were raised the same way because my point is that I think all toddlers try it.
Oh, yes.
And then, that would not have flown in our household.
Parents who understand what they're dealing with go ahead and set limits, and they set boundaries. They can do that in a loving way. They can do that in a kind way, but they have to set limits. But it makes the point that the left culturally has understood that in political terms, we're like the tired parents who eventually want to go do something else. We don't want to spend all of our time face-to-face dealing with liberals. And so they have understood that if they pressure long enough and hard enough, we will eventually compromise. And that's how we've gotten in the mess we're in now. And that's why we have to have this delicate discussion about we've gone so far, we can't just suddenly turn back to constitutional government or to free enterprise. We're going to have to work our way back. And I think it's every toddler in the world has understood that at some point. Some of them learn. One of the cases I make when I'm speaking around the country is, you know, in a way, we're all born liberal. We're all born with this sense that if we make enough noise, the world will come and make us feel better. And if we want something, then somebody else should bring it to us. You know, that's kind of our human nature.
And the world operates on emotion only. There is no fact.
The world operates on emotion. If you like it, it is good. If you don't like it, it is bad. And that's the toddler's view of the world. The whole process of maturing is learning that the world doesn't revolve around you, that other people don't owe you a living, that when you don't get something you want, then sometimes you have to cowboy up and deal with it, and sometimes you just have to go out and work harder. That's part of the maturing process.
Man, that is some tough talk right there. I don't know if that's going to apply at all.
That's just meanness right there.
Boy.
that's the way I was raised, and I think that I've often said the founders, the Constitution wasn't just made for moral and religious people, as the founders said. It was also made for mature people who were willing to live, who were willing to mind their own business and leave other people free to do the same. It doesn't mean that we can't cooperate. It doesn't mean that we can't join forces, but it means that we do that voluntarily. And our Constitution was set up to mean that when lots of us agree that something is a good plan, then that is more tolerable. And that's why we have all these barriers that the left calls gridlock. But all those barriers were built into the Constitution to keep a minority from pushing their point of view on the rest of the population. And so I think we've got a lot of work to do. And one of the points I've been making around the country is we can't just think about the tip of the political iceberg. Elected office is the tip of the political iceberg. Real power is down underneath the surface. It's in the culture. And you were making some good points earlier about if we suddenly were to enact all kinds of changes that might be good changes on the surface, we'd get thrown out of office the next time around because our culture hasn't changed. And the left has been working for decades to change our culture. And I think we as conservatives need to realize that the battle is across your backyard fence. It's talking to your neighbor. It's making the case for what we want to do. And it can't always be a negative case. It's got to be a positive case for why liberty works.
Yeah, I think that's true. And we have to, I think it's incumbent upon people, and it's a pain, but they need to do their homework, you know? I mean, it's very easy to take a little soundbite. We were having this discussion in the chat room earlier about a bill There was a bill that went through, and the bill changed along the way. Well, a representative voted one way on part of the bill. It went over to the Senate. It changed. It got conferenced and passed. But because people don't know the process, well, he voted yes for that. Well, no, he really didn't. That's the way the bill turned out, but that wasn't what he voted for initially. So some of it, I think we get hung up, you know, we get jammed because we don't know. We don't know the process.
I think you're so right, and that's why I say mainstream America has for too long, I think, we have enjoyed the benefits of liberty, we've enjoyed the prosperity, we've enjoyed the freedom, but we have forgotten what our founders told us, that the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. And that eternal vigilance means it's not just putting people in office and hoping they'll do the right thing. We have to understand the process. We have to understand our founding documents. We have to understand more about politics. And I think so many mainstream Americans will say, I just don't like politics. It's so dirty. Well, you know, I'd say you got to just cowboy up and deal with it, because that's the nature of the game. And it is complicated. Yes, there are processes that we have to understand. You have to understand sometimes that somebody voted against a bill, but it was because of an amendment in that bill. You see that kind of thing all the time in commercials. Well, so-and-so voted against feeding the hungry. Well, okay, but there was some bill, some amendment that was attached to a much larger bill, and an ill-informed population will fall for that kind of chicanery every time. I think you're spot on. We have got to do a better job of informing ourselves.
And it's not coming from the news. You know, it isn't coming from the news. And someone said, well, we should have heard about that at the town hall. And it was specifically about the farm bill. And I reminded them that back when we had that town hall, the farm bill was two bills. It was two different bills. The 80% that involved food stamps was a separate bill at that time. So, I mean, I realize everybody doesn't have, you know, because I can hear people out there, I can hear myself, you know, saying, well, what the heck? You know, people have to, like, what, give up their job, their family, everything, just focus on this stuff? Well, no, but you should get a contact in your representative's office and make sure that actually what you're mad about is really fact.
I think that is a critical point in and of itself. The left lives and breathes politics because they're all about getting their way. They're ultimately, they're the toddlers that never matured in one sense. They're in that they have an agenda. They're going to push that agenda at all costs. They're willing to make any amount of noise and create any amount of distress in other people in order to do that. And I'm talking about the hardcore left here. And that's a small minority, but it's the hardcore left that are driving the agenda.
No, you're right. And you know, when you talk to the base of the heart of the left, they're no more informed about these processes than we are.
No, they're really not.
They're really not. And when you do hit them with just a few facts, they're out of the game. You know, and that swings both ways. You know, so we all have a responsibility to learn the facts before we go out and shoot ourselves in the foot or try to shoot somebody else in the foot.
Yeah, we've got to hold people accountable based on fact. We're going to come right back with Dr. Tim Daughtry. We are discussing all the things about grassroots politics here. We'll just call it that. And his book, Waking the Sleeping Giant. Good read. Be right back with you in 2 minutes. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
It's over. The sky is falling.
No, we're waiting for the sign.
Make the mistake.
That's good. You're joining We the People Radio. Got Bob, Aaron, Bill. It's Full House today. And we've got Dr. Tim Daughtry on the line with us. Hey, I wanted to throw out one more thing. I got an email from a listener, and they are at the gun show in Reading this weekend, actually at the convention center. They are raising money to help a girl who needs to build a handicap bathroom. They need to build a handicap bathroom for her, and I have a my stepdad, who's a paraplegic, and we had to retrofit our house for a wheelchair, and I got to tell you, it's not cheap, and it isn't easy. So they could use your help if you're so inclined. We're going to add this to the website for you. But if you go to the gun show this weekend, there is, it is George Ireton who's doing it, and I'm going to put all this on here. If you're not able to do that, they're selling tickets at the Reading Gun Club, Coldwell Banker, all sorts of other spots. You can go to rafflerules.com, RAFFLERULES.com, and I read about the gun raffle that they're using to raise money. And there are also links there. We're going to put them on our website as well. There are links to what this girl's story is. Yeah. So we're not going to get into that whole thing, but wanted to put a plug in for them and let you know there's a gun show in Reading today. I guess that's a good note, too.
And that gun show is, I think it must be doing pretty good. I was there yesterday at I think around 10:30, and there was still a line when I got to the door. There was probably 25 people ahead of me in line just to get in. It was
nice.
Pretty crowded.
Nice, popular.
So, yeah, they got a good turnout.
And Bob's
and that is at the Reading Civic Auditorium this weekend.
That's correct.
Yeah, what did I call it? Convention Center?
Oh, I'm not sure what you... I was just trying to...
Yeah, Civic Auditorium is...
It's easier for people who think it might be at the fairgrounds.
Oh, yes. No, it's at the big stone building by the Sundial Bridge. Okay, back with Dr. Tim Daughtry. All right, so let's swing back into where we were, and or wherever you'd like to take us, actually. Maybe we ought to do that.
Well, I think you made a great point earlier about we're not saying that mainstream Americans need to become just totally immersed in politics like the left. And that was my point before the break, that the left lives and breathes this stuff because it's all about power and they're all about power. But I think we do have to do a better job of being informed and beginning to understand the political process. I moderated a town hall the other night. And there were a number of good conservative candidates there, and this was pretty much a Tea Party audience, or a Tea Party-friendly audience. Well, the candidates all got questions about Obamacare, and to a person, the candidates all basically said, well, the federal government has no role in health care, period. And they got cheers from the audience. The audience loved it. I was talking to the candidates afterwards, and I said, well, how'd you think we did? And my argument is you would win the Tea Party vote, but you'll lose the election if you continue to say that. It's one thing, and that's what I meant when I said we've got to learn to talk about the positive side of free markets, make a case for liberty, not just speak against what the left is doing. So my argument about Obamacare is there are positive alternatives that are market-driven. They're saying things such as portability of insurance for one reform that we could do, for example, is why do you have to work for a company in order for the company to get a tax break on your insurance? Why not let that be an individual, benefit? That you get insurance, you sign up with the company, and you get the tax break. There are things that we can offer as alternatives to Obamacare, because I think Obamacare is critical. It's critical right now because the left has had this long march, as they called it decades ago. They called it the long march toward socialism, and an early leftist said, I think it was back in the 1930s, that America will never accept socialism if you call it socialism, but they'll accept socialism on the installment plan. And Obamacare is the next of the last installment. If we let Obamacare stand, if the government can take over our health care, tie everything to our tax system, bring in more IRS agents and so forth, then they're going to have a power over people that is going to be very difficult to undo. So I think that's a perfect example of where we've got to have positive solutions. And when I said that to those candidates, when I said, guys, there are free market solutions and the federal government can make some changes that will improve health care, and they will appeal to the average American. They'll appeal to enough voters that we can actually win. What they said is, yeah, but you're accepting the premise that government has a role in health care. I'm not accepting that premise. I'm accepting reality. I'm accepting the reality that government does right now work in the health care field. That government has just seized more power, and that we can actually roll that back. We're not going to roll it back to the point that government has no role in health care. We're just not going to get there without creating chaos.
Yeah, well, government was in. They were involved in health care prior. You know, it's not like government just got involved in healthcare with Obamacare.
Absolutely, and that's why
they were messing it up before Obamacare.
Absolutely, and that's why it was a little bit scary, because I was thinking these are good candidates, their heart's in the right place, but a lot of these are folks that are first-time office holders or first-time candidates, and they're doing a great job of reading out of the civics book, but they don't understand the political process. Even if they could get elected, if they carried out what they're talking about, we would have chaos. And you know, the left understands the power of chaos. The whole idea of the Cloward-Piven strategy is to overload the system, create chaos, realizing that when there is enough pain, people won't care about the Constitution, they won't care about rights, they won't care about the long term, they will simply say, ease my pain. And that's what concerns me right now. If we were to enact radical changes, and I don't think we could, but if we were to, I think all we're going to do is set the stage for the left to come back stronger next time. So again, I think a major theme of the show today has been, if we can get mainstream conservatives to begin to think long term and realize that we've got to be in this for the long haul, and that's going to mean there are going to be some times that we have to compromise strategically in order to regain some of the ground that we've lost.
And you brought up a great point. You know, when we're not happy with a politician, we vote them out of office. And in a lot of cases, we vote people in that have never been there before. They're the local shopkeeper, so to speak. And when they get back there, I think they realize that it's a great big pond they're swimming in back there, and we have to help them understand and not throw them under the bus every time they open their mouth and say something that isn't quite right. I mean, they're getting an education just like we're getting an education.
Absolutely. It's a complicated process, and it's like the point you were making earlier about the process by which a bill becomes law. There are a lot of steps there. And if we panic or overreact every time somebody votes on some procedural step that we don't like, then we're going to end up constantly just churning our politicians. We'll put somebody in office and then we'll throw them out next time. And it just creates chaos. I think we've got to think bigger picture. Now, I'm not advocating. A lot of times people say, well, you're sounding like a moderate. I'm not. I'm a conservative, but I think we've got to think strategically. Now, decades ago, we could have been stricter about this, but we have lost so much ground.
Yeah.
That we have got to think in terms of regaining ground, and that's not going to be an overnight process. It's not going to be one election, and it's not going to be a small number of politicians. We're going to have to, as the left used to say, we're going to have to change the system, and that's going to take some time.
No, and the left's not throwing their guys out. They're completely happy with what the results have been.
Even if they're not.
They're seasoned pros.
Yeah, but even if they're not happy, I mean, that's been my gripe the last 5 years. That's what I've watched is, just on a larger scale, not just locally, but you know, conservatives will, you know, they'll nitpick, and I don't mean that necessarily in a bad way, but you know, they'll go through all the policy and they'll peel things apart, and the left will do that too. But when conservatives walk into the ballot box, they become surgeons. You know, oh, he's got this. I'm not going to vote. I'm not going to vote for that guy. I'm not going to vote for anybody in that office. They'll walk away without casting a ballot, so they don't have to, what is it, feel dirty or whatever. You know, it's the...
Oh, their integrity.
Compromise their principles or vote for the lesser of two evils. And the left, man, they walk in, they vote for the guy with the D. I mean, he could be a Republican running as a Democrat, and if he had a D behind his name, bam, they vote for him.
And that, I think you're so spot on there, because that's where we have to think strategically, we have to think long term, we have to understand the political process. Here in North Carolina, we got the trifecta. We won the we kind of went against the electoral trend in 2012. We actually got the governor's mansion, we got the lieutenant governor, we've got a lieutenant governor who never held political office before, but was a strong Tea Party candidate. We won that race, and we got both houses of the state legislature. And so conservatives were saying, oh, wow, now we're going to turn back decades and decades and decades of liberal rule in North Carolina. Well, we've made significant gains in tax policy. We've got photo ID for voters. We've got all kinds of things, and I constantly hear, but they didn't do enough here, they compromised on this, they compromised on that. And I'm saying, my goodness, people, look at how much they gained in 2 years' time. And you know, it's gonna take years to undo some of the stuff that we're trying to do.
Yeah.
And they're saying, well, they didn't eliminate the income tax. Well, okay, fine, but they cut taxes. That in itself is a major step. So I think we've got to learn to think again long term and think strategically. And that means we can't just keep throwing politicians out every time they're not perfect, because we're going to replace them with imperfect people working in an imperfect system.
Yeah. Back at the end of the day, we're still going to have regular old boring flawed humans at the helm. You know,
I hate that.
The perfect people are never coming. We've got to take a really quick break so we can get a word in from our advertisers. We're here with Dr. Tim Daughtry. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We're here at KCNR 1460 AM. A sad country song is the one about compromise.
Excellent choice.
That's a good one. I'm sure later on the dog dies, the wife leaves. I'm sure there's more sadness. Oh my gosh, that's so funny. Well, I was just saying on the break that honestly, you are the deliverer of the message that I really, really have embraced for the last 5 years. And you know, you do run the risk of being branded as, oh, you're a moderate, you're not really in it for the fight. And it's like, you know, I'm the oldest of five kids, and I guess I just am hardwired about winning. it's just a nasty need to win.
Yeah, I think anyone who reads Waking the Sleeping Giant would realize that I am not a moderate. In fact, I've said on many occasions that moderates are merely socialists in slow motion. if we constantly appease and lose ground, what we're talking about here is different. It is a different way for conservatives to think. And that is that, yes, we have to compromise, but we compromise to gain ground. And that's a new way of thinking. We're not used to doing that. And I think conservatives for too long, as I said at the very beginning, we've been a defensive movement for so long. We've waited for the left to move, and then we try to resist. That this whole idea of gaining ground instead of trying to lose less ground, it's going to take some time to get our minds around that. But that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a proactive, aggressive conservative movement that is making the case for liberty, taking the case out into neighborhoods where we haven't been before, making a positive case for liberty instead of constantly talking about what's wrong with government. Yeah, we have to talk about what's wrong with government, but that's 20% of it. The rest of the time we need to be talking about why what we're talking about will work better, and we have to be willing to get there a step at the time, because we didn't get in this mess overnight. We're not going to get out of it overnight.
I think that's the biggest point that we need to get through to people is it's not going to be a perfect vote. It's not going to be a perfect candidate. We're going to
have to go back to small steps and
get back to where we started.
Yeah, and we're not going to go back to one-page bills. You know, people are like, well, we have to go to a gold standard. We've got to go back to bills that are one-page long. Things that are just those things are not coming. if ever, I mean, for a very long time.
They're not coming in our lifetime.
No. No, and it was funny, yesterday I was I attended a constitutional seminar up north of here, and the guy was, he was advocating some, I mean, legitimate constitutional stuff, but fairly radical. And, you know, someone said, well, how do we, one of the questions was, you know, in the sidelines on a break was, well, if we wanted to engineer a tax revolt in this country, you know, how would we do it? We'd have to do it like the founding fathers did. And it's like, hey, newsflash. We never again get to do anything like they did. There are more of us, for starters. Cell phones, cameras. I mean, we never get the anonymity that they were able to have.
Yeah.
We can't just wear a powdered wig and sneak into a, you know, a really hot room somewhere in the backside of town. It doesn't work that way anymore.
You know, the image I've been using to try to get that point across is that liberty is like a light. And that light doesn't change. That's the light that George Washington saw at Valley Forge. It's the light that Ronald Reagan saw. It's the light that guides us. But you shine that light on new problems and new technologies and new demographics. So the light doesn't change, but what you're looking at is going to change. America is a very different country than it was 200 years ago.
Yeah.
We've got different technologies. We've got different demographic changes. So the concept is the same. The principle is the same. The light is the same, but it's going to be shining on a different landscape. And if we naively think that we're just going to go back to what the founders did, we would be toast. Politically, we would be toast because it would be such a shock to the system that we'd be thrown out. And secondly, I think we'd create chaos. So I think we have to take the principles, the core principles of conservatism, that government shouldn't, that federal government shouldn't do things that can be done by state government. State government shouldn't be doing things that can be done by local governments and by individuals. Take that principle and apply that to the 21st century. It's not going to look like it did two centuries ago. So I think if we take those basic principles, we can still have a strong, thriving conservative movement, and we can turn this country back onto a safe course and to a sane course. We can't do that if we don't learn to think politically, though.
No, and we have to be, we do have to be strategic. You know, I get people all the time, well, we've got to get Boehner out of there, we've got to get Boehner out of there. And if you say anything contrary to that, then, well, you must like him. Well, okay, no. But I'm thinking, if I'm trapped in a room with Harry Reid and John Boehner, I mean, and people don't like this analogy because they, well, that's not happening. Well, work with me. If you're stuck with Harry Reid and John Boehner, who do you have a chance with? Not who's going to achieve perfection in your lifetime, but who do you have a chance with? Because I would submit you got zip going with Harry Reid. So as far as I'm concerned, your entire focus better be on Harry Reid.
You know, it's like Reagan used to say, I'll take somebody that I agree with 80% of the time rather than wait for somebody I agree with 100% of the time, because you're not going to get somebody you agree with 100% of the time. Conservatism is a diverse movement. Liberalism is not that diverse. If you look at any major liberal candidate, they are lockstep on every major issue. Conservatism is actually more diverse. The left has seized the term diversity, but we're the ones who actually live it. And so you're not going to agree 100% with any candidate. So I have had to bite my lip a number of times and support somebody that I agree with 80% of the time,
sure,
realizing that the alternative is going to disagree with me 100% of the time.
And that's a great point. Because I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say, well, he's not what I represent. I'm not voting for him. I'm going to vote the other way.
Or I'm not going to vote at all. That's my favorite.
Yeah.
You can't
do that.
Well, let me put it this way. Mitt Romney wasn't my first choice. He wasn't my second choice. He wasn't my third choice. Suppose Mitt Romney had won the election in 2012. Do you think America would be better off now? Would we be closer to constitutional government, or would we be worse off? I think we would have had some economic changes that would have been positive. And that alone would have been a major gain. Now, again, he wasn't my first candidate. He wasn't an ideal candidate. But too many people stayed home and said, well, I'd rather, you know, I'm just not going to vote. Too many people said, well, he's not the perfect candidate. Well, no, he wasn't the perfect candidate. But my goodness, Obama was the alternative.
Exactly. And I guarantee you, had he been elected, you wouldn't be seeing the executive orders that I think this country is in for in the next 2 years.
But you know the part that's funny is, I actually have had people say, and not just one, but many people say that actually it was better to have Obama because he would hasten the demise and wake people up. Mitt Romney would have still been part of the, you know, the slow, slippery slope to, you know, socialism.
I've heard that argument, and I think years ago that argument would have carried more weight, but I still believe this idea that the left's long march is almost complete. They have almost taken us to European-style socialism. And although I understand the whole principle of appeasement and so forth, and I've written about it, I've written that we've got to break the appeasement cycle, but I think our backs are against the wall of European-style socialism right now, and Obama, having four more years, will take us, because of the executive orders, he's wearing away the Constitution, he's wearing away the willingness of the legislative branch to do their job and hold them accountable and apply checks and balances. I think we needed to buy time, and that was my argument. That's why I can sometimes hold my nose and vote for a candidate that I don't like that much, if I think they will at least buy time for us to make the real change we need to make, which is to change the narrative in the culture. See, we keep thinking that politics is about what's happening in government.
Right.
Government is the tip of the iceberg. Conservatives have to win the culture back, and that means we have to convince people that the Constitution is a good idea. We have to convince people that there is a better way, and that's going to take some time. And I think right now I'll vote for a candidate that'll do nothing more than buy us some time and slow down the march towards socialism, because that buys us time. If we don't do that, I don't think we'll survive another left-wing president. Let's put it that way.
No, I don't think we will
think
either.
With the tolerance that we've seen for the unconstitutional executive orders, I mean, we've got somebody who's basically behaving like a king, and America, for the most part, is tolerating that. So I think we've got to buy time first. Short term, we've got to buy time in order to carry out a long-term strategy.
I think so, too. All right, our final break. It seems like we've had extra breaks today, but we really haven't. We just want to hear you talk, Tim. That's the whole thing. It's like, dang it, we have to interrupt him again. But we love advertisers. They make the radio go round. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. And the gun raffle info for Trina Lay is on the website just below the video of Tim Daughtry. It's a short stretch. Don't stretch long. You'll miss it.
Yeah.
All right. We're here with Dr. Tim Daughtry, Waking the Sleeping Giant. Okay, so how about some, I don't know, I was going to say marching orders, but the right doesn't march very well. We don't like to be told to march.
It's like herding cats.
A little bit. You know, people, you know, that's the thing. It's no different than if you have smart children, smart dogs. You know, anything that you're trying to sort of get to go your way, it's tough. I mean, if they're smart, that's great, but they're a lot more work. I think our guys are logical. I think they're pretty smart. I think they have a lot of heart. And so for that reason, it's a little harder.
It's harder to get our side together, but I've been finding audiences around the country are very receptive to a few things that we need to do differently. And first off, and this is very encouraging, people are realizing, mainstream conservatives are realizing, we've got to get off the defensive. We cannot win a defensive struggle. And so I think that's the major thing, is that we've got to stop waiting for the left to attack, and then we resist, and then us having to resist the left. I think we've got to go out and start making the case for free enterprise, making the case for liberty. Secondly, I think we need to think strategically and generationally. We need to start thinking long term. The left has been focused on winning the next generation. We're going to have to start thinking in terms of winning this country back a step at a time. Thirdly, and we talked about it for the whole show, we've got to learn the difference between appeasement and strategic compromise. If we can gain ground, then a compromise is okay, because we can always come back and gain more ground. We've just got to stop losing liberty. And I think we've got a tool here that we haven't used before. The grassroots is mobilized. The grassroots is ready. If we can get this giant grassroots movement to realize that we need to be moving out into our communities, moving out into our neighborhoods, and making the case for liberty instead of just talking. We can't just go to rallies and talk about what's wrong with government. We've got to be out in the neighborhoods, engaging people and making the case for liberty. And finally, I think we've got to unite around core issues. We're not going to agree on everything, but we can agree, number one, that Obamacare is a disaster. We can have free market solutions to that. We can disagree about all other kinds of things, but we can unite around some core issues. We've got too much government. It costs too much, and our debt is going to kill us and our children. Unite around those issues and buy time. And I think, finally, I think we need to take our language back. We have let the left for too long control the high ground of our language. Fair share, choice, diversity, tolerance, all these things that the left talks about. The left practices none of those. So I think we need to get better at making the positive case for liberty, because if you want to talk about freedom of choice, my goodness, conservatives are your guys, but we just don't make that case well enough.
No, I don't think we do either, and I do think the defensive is always there, and the problem is, because we're unwilling to, you know, I guess mix it up with the left on a regular basis, what happens is they gain tons of ground. See, up here we've got all sorts of issues with land and water and that sort of thing. So the left sues our conservatives, you know, our farmers and ranchers that are just out there working, trying to do their job, and because they see that it'll go forever and ever and ever, the ranchers and farmers pay the extortion just to get away from them.
Well, it's
which,
they start
works.
They start the conversation with, what are you willing to give up to keep your liberty? Well, I don't want to start there.
Oh, yeah, we debate the left on the left's terms. We
right.
Let them set the terms of debate. And that's the major change in our mindset, I think, that is going to be necessary for us to win this struggle.
Yeah. Well, advice for grassroots groups going into 2014 here in the last minute?
Yeah, hang together. Don't get discouraged. Remember, there's a wonderful picture of George Washington kneeling in prayer at Valley Forge. It's by Arnold Freeberg. It's very popular among the conservative movement. But when you see that picture, always remember that he didn't know that Yorktown was coming. He didn't know that victory was coming. But what he realized was they could not stay at Valley Forge, and that was when they crossed the Delaware, went on the offensive. So just when our folks are feeling discouraged and feeling like we've lost too much, remember those moments. We've had our backs against the wall before. As long as we go on offense and as long as we think long term, we can turn this country around.
Yeah, and I have it on.
I believe that as well.
And I have it on pretty good word that of the 220-something Republicans in the House of Representatives, like 185 of them are mostly folks like us. You know, regular thinking folks, but we just don't ever see them on the news. We see the same five, you know, the same five people, and everybody goes, "Oh, they're all against us." It's not necessarily true. Just got to remember that's what we see sometimes.
I think so.
Well, we appreciate your message very much. We appreciate your book
a great deal. Thanks for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Hey, if you're ever out west, we would love to see you. We'll communicate by email. You've been listening to We the People Radio with Dr. Tim Daughtry, author of Waking the Sleeping Giant. And next is Sovereign Minds with Mark and Linda Kent. Going to be a great program. And that's mostly it. Bob? Got 10 seconds.
All right. Thank you,
Spend
Dr. Daughtry. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Aaron. Sovereign Minds is next here at KCNR, Shasta Redding.
Bye.